You're listening to Calling All Pets from Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Larry Mueller here along with Public Radio's favorite zoologist, Patricia McConnell. If you have a question about your animal's behavior, give us a call right now. Our number is 1-800-462-7413. That's 1-800-462-7413. In addition to the calls, we'll discuss another special topic. And what is it this time, Patricia?
We'll find out if size matters when it comes to dominance in white-tailed deer. And we'll talk a little bit about why dominance hierarchies are so important in the first place.
Very cool. And this week, we'll welcome a guest to talk about the birds of the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. We'll hear about their migratory habits and about their life in the Arctic. And that's still to come. But first, it's time to take some of your calls. Hi, you're on Calling All Pets.
Hi, Patricia and Larry. This is Nancy from Onalaska, Wisconsin.
Nancy, pleasure to speak with you. What's on your mind?
I have a six-year-old tabby cat with polydactyl paws. And on each front paw, she has these large thumbs. One of them even has two claws. And in addition, on each front paw, between her thumb and her first toe, she has another toe that's set back quite far, kind of in that webbing between your thumb and your finger.
Right.
And those claws are quite thick, and as they grow, they curl around, and they get close to becoming embedded in the toe pad. Now, my husband, bless his heart, and I have tried to trim her claws, but she won't have anything to do with it. And now we're taking her to the clinic about every 2 to 3 months to let them do it.
Right.
Now, the last time she went, it took three people to hold her.
Oh, dear.
And she put up such a fuss that the doctor recommended from now on she'd have to be anesthetized or else be declawed.
Oh.
Well, if that was meant to scare me, it worked. And I called the clinic and I spoke with a different doctor who was willing to come to the house and give it a try. And that worked much better, but I know that's... house calls aren't a long-term solution.
Yeah, that's right. A great veterinarian, isn't it?
Yeah. Really nice.
Oh, what a sweetie.
She was just sweet. And I thought, since I trust your advice and you have such a kind way with animals, I thought it was time to give you a call and ask what you would recommend.
It is a tricky one. You know, so many of our pets don't like having their nails trimmed. A lot of dogs don't and a lot of cats don't. And I would think about what kind of kind, humane restraint system can I use?
Oh, okay.
And one of the things that people who work with cats know is that one of their best friends is a pillowcase.
I thought you were going to say a straitjacket.
Right, right. They're well, sort of, it's basically
it
a
is.
Similar idea, right? Now, the trick is obviously a cat in a pillowcase doesn't have a paw available. So one of the things to think about, and I would have to think about it a little bit more in terms of to be really specific for you. Basically, what you want is a way to sort of swaddle your cat. That's what I would teach your cat, is how to be comfortable being swaddled. So don't associate it with the clippers. Don't pick up the clippers. Just get the best little piece of chicken or turkey or, you know, something that your kitty absolutely adores. And get your kitty comfortable being wrapped in some kind of a swaddling cloth with just one foreleg out and the rest of the cat wrapped up. And then once you've conditioned that, then you can do the trimming really quickly and then just get it over with.
And you've got 2 or 3 months between clippings to work with
right.
the kitty.
So.
And my clinic would be open to that suggestion if I made the suggestion?
I'm sure they'd be very open. They'd be very happy to help you find some humane way. Yeah.
Thanks a lot, Nancy.
Okay.
Good luck.
Thank you.
Appreciate the call very much. Tricia, we received an email from Mary and Doug in Anchorage, Alaska. It's kind of foot-related. He was just talking about the kitty here. But they have a 14-year-old dog named Pepper that's lived outside most of her life. But they need your advice about how to protect the dog in the cold Alaska winter. And here's what they write. How do we keep our dog's feet warm in the winter? Pepper hates to be inside, and while she has an insulated doghouse with cedar chip bedding, we're not sure she even goes inside the doghouse. We take the dog on daily walks, but her feet are very tender, and while she might wear booties on the walk, she probably won't keep them on while she's in the yard. Maybe she really isn't as cold as we think, but it's got to be a problem when it gets to be 0 degrees outside. What can we do?
Well, it's a good question, and your dog is going to tell you if it's a problem or not. You know, they get to say, and don't make the mistake I made of obsessively putting new hay and straw in my dog's doghouse, and then every night my dog would dig it out. And I would come out in the morning, and she'd be lying on a slab of ice. And I finally got the picture that she didn't want me to put nice, warm, toasty stuff in her doghouse. She wanted to lie on plain wood. So, you know, this is a good example of how being anthropomorphic, putting ourselves in an animal's place or imagining them being human-like, is not always so useful. If your dog's feet are uncomfortable in the cold, and by the way, zero is not that cold for a hardy northern type of dog. If your dog's feet are uncomfortable, he or she will pick them up often and repeatedly. He'll pick up one and hold it up a little bit and then put it down, then pick up the other one. That's a very good sign. They will spend a lot of time licking them, which could also make it worse.
Right.
Because then they're obviously wet, and,
sure,
and then that can exacerbate it. But if your dog, you know, you said your dog's paws are sensitive. I guess my question would be, if I was up there with you, is well, why do you say that?
Yeah.
You know,
What's going on?
Yeah, what does your dog do that makes you say that they're sensitive? So if the yard is a small yard, you might want to consider putting wood chips or straw over the ice in the whole yard. I don't know how big it is. If your dog doesn't use the doghouse, you might want to reconsider, you know, build something a little different because your dog is saying, I'm sorry, I don't want to rent that particular property. But if your dog appears to be, to all intents and purposes, comfortable, then it probably is.
Don't worry about it.
Yeah.
Okay.
Worry about something else.
How do people email us questions, by the way?
Oh, we love to hear from you. Please send us your questions or comments to pets@wpr.org.
And if you'd like to call us, here's that number, 1-800-462-7413. Matter of fact, we have somebody online. Hi, you're on Calling All Pets.
Oh, hi. How are you guys doing?
Just great. Who are we speaking with?
My name is Jim, and I'm calling from Beulah, Michigan.
Jim, thank you very much for calling. What can we do for you?
Well, thanks for having me on the show.
Sure.
It's sort of an interesting problem. I have a cat, and he's an indoor-outdoor cat. And I live in an area where it's very rural, so he's got lots of mice to chase and things like that. So he's outside a lot. He really likes that. But he also really likes coming in and demanding some affection, getting some food, and then going back out again.
Right.
So anyway, my girlfriend comes up to visit me once a month for a weekend. She's allergic to cats.
Ooh.
So what I've been doing is cleaning the house really good before she gets there and taking the cat to the kennel for the weekend. For Thanksgiving, I just decided, well, you know, this is going to be like an extra long one, like 5 days she's going to be here. I don't know about having the cat at the kennel for 5 days.
Mm.
So what we did is my housemate and I set up a little cozy little corner for Cool Cat out in the garage and put his food out there and just didn't let him in the house for 4 or 5 days.
Okay.
And it seemed to really upset him and confuse him. And he didn't really seem to eat his food very well, and mostly we were using treats to, you know, get him away from the house and get him to go look at his food in his new little spot. I have no idea what he did at night while he did at night. So anyway, I'm just wondering what you think in terms of cat psychology.
Sure.
Which is easier on the cat?
Do you know how he behaves at the boarding kennel? Have you talked to the kennel owners?
I have no idea.
Well, that's the first thing you need to know.
Yeah.
Is because you're comparing two things, right? But you don't know, you don't know what kind of apple you have. You know your orange, but you don't know your apple. So that's the first thing I do is I'd gather data, is call the boarding kennel and get as accurate, and don't accept a sort of generic, oh, he's fine. You know, be very specific. What does he spend his time doing? Does he eat his food? How much of it does he eat? Is he friendly? Describe if I walked in what he would be doing. You know, get very, very good, clear observational comments from them rather than sort of he's fine or he's not fine.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
So that's one thing I do. Other thing you might want to think about is getting him used to this garage on a sort of slower basis. Is start incorporating it more into his normal life. Start putting extra good food there. Not when your girlfriend is there, but just during normal life, start giving him reasons to want to spend time in the garage. Because cats are so territorially conscious. They're so location specific. You know, one of the sayings is that dogs go with people and cats go with places.
Yes.
So, and not to hurt anybody's feelings here, I know there are lots of cats who love their humans, but nonetheless, it's where a cat is extremely important to a cat. And so you want to get him more used to this garage. Spend some time in there yourself. You know, put a couch in there and you hang out in the garage. Make it a more familiar place to him. That might be a solution. But until you know how he is in the boarding kennel, it's going to be hard to compare which one's better. You also might want to talk to your girlfriend about things she can do, depending on how motivated she is, about her allergies to cats. There are things you can do. I'm actually allergic to cats. I have a cat. He sleeps on my bed. Partly why I sound like I have low-grade asthma all the time. But nonetheless, that's a choice I make. Obviously, I don't have serious asthma. I couldn't do it. But I take homeopathic drops, which you can get at any all sort of large pharmacy, especially one that specializes in adjunctive or alternative medicine. Take homeopathic drops for animal dander. There are also not vaccinations. There's a series of shots you can get that kind of ameliorate a lot of your body's responses to these antigens. I actually have those shots to myself, and it's what allows me to spend time with dogs, actually.
Oh.
So there are other alternatives. Or you could put your girlfriend in the garage. And no, we'll stop there. Anyway, so those are some good ideas.
Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call very much. 1-800-462-7413. The number to call. Coming up next, we'll examine whether bigger is better if you're a white-tailed deer hoping to be the head of the herd. I'm Larry Mueller with Patricia McConnell, and this is Calling All Pets from Wisconsin Public Radio.
The Calling All Pets website offers you the opportunity to submit email questions, browse pet tips, and find out when Patricia will be in a city near you. Information online at callingallpets.org. That's callingallpets.org. Pet books and training guides are also available through the radio store at 800-747-7444.
I'm Larry Mueller, along with Public Radio's favorite zoologist, Patricia McConnell, and this is Calling All Pets from Wisconsin Public Radio. Time for this week's topic, and Tricia, you have some research to share with us about dominance in deer, isn't that right?
I do. You know, as most of us know, many species of animals resolve conflicts by establishing dominance hierarchies, right?
Yeah, sure. And we hear a lot about dominance hierarchies in dogs on this show, don't we?
We do. Although I have to say, dominance in dog behavior is just exaggerated a lot, right?
Yeah,
well, we've talked about that's a whole other topic.
We'll go there some other time.
We'll go there. But dominance hierarchies are very common in a lot of domestic and wild animals, especially hoofed animals like sheep, white-tailed deer.
All right. So how do white-tailed deer establish and maintain these hierarchies?
Well, that's a really good question because we haven't known a lot about how these hierarchies are actually established. And a recent study by Talon and Cote, published in the Journal of Animal Behavior,
not surprisingly,
examined this very question. And here's what they found. They found that male deer fawns initially established social rankings based on body size. So the larger the individual was, the more likely he was to be dominant. Meaning, for example, if there was food in a trough, he got it.
And the other ones
didn't. And the other one did not,
okay.
Right.
So size matters, so to speak.
Well, you know, It doesn't. It turns out to be a little bit more complicated than that because they continued to study and they found that in a subsequent year, the size of these same individuals was actually irrelevant.
Hmm.
It turned out that males who were dominant in encounters the year before were still head of the herd. They still got the food no matter how large the other individuals had become.
Okay, so dominance has more to do with that initial, that first encounter rather than with body size.
Right. That's right. It turns out that hierarchies are established early in life. Size is important then. But once established, hierarchies tend to stay the same, no matter how big or how small the individuals become. And that's, you know, if you think about the animals that we live with in our houses, like dogs.
Dogs, sure.
A lot of people, and we all know this, you know, you have a tiny little dog who totally lords it over a larger one. And those are probably, again, based on differences in early interactions and differences in personality.
But why are dominance hierarchies important anyway?
Well, people often associate them with aggression, and the truth of the matter is they're actually designed, they're not designed, but they actually evolved to prevent aggression. Hmm. You know, if you have, I mean, think about it. If you have a limited resource and you and two individuals want it, you can either fight for it, which
every
is
darn time.
Every single time. But if you have an established hierarchy, then you don't have to have a conflict over it every time. It's sort of settled.
People, we have a great resource here in Patricia McConnell.
We're fighting. Oh, please fight over me. Please fight over me.
You don't have to be part of a dominance hierarchy to talk with her. Just give us a call. Here's the number, 1-800-462-7413. And we have someone waiting to talk with us right now. Hi, you're on Calling All Pets.
Hi, this is Christy.
Christy, where are you calling from?
I'm calling from Watertown, Wisconsin.
It's a great pleasure to speak with you.
Nice to talk to you, and love your show.
Thank you.
I would like to know if Patricia could help me. I'd like to train my chinchilla maybe to pee. Can a chinchilla be trained to pee in one spot or, you know, potty train it?
I don't know. That's the answer to that question. I could make it up, but the fact of the matter is I don't know. Now, let's think about, you know, like PhDs are stand for piled higher and deeper, as we all know. And part of what you learn, actually, when you're getting a PhD is to stop and go, okay, well, what do I know? What do we know about chinchillas?
There's not a large body of research on
this.
Well,
but a lot of people know a lot more than I do about chinchillas, and we do know something about the way they live in the wild. And what I don't know is whether they urinate in their dens or not. There are some, you know, they're denning animals. They live underground. I think they like to be in rocks a lot. And so here's a question to find out is, does this species, and maybe we could get information from our listeners, is this one of these species who urinates in their den as a way of a marker? Or is it a species who keeps their dens completely clean? So that some of the rodents urinate in their dens. Animals like wolves, for example, do not urinate in their dens. So that's part of the question. Well, let's ask our caller. What do you know about the natural history of chinchillas?
I don't know a real lot about them. I just know I got a cage is 20 by 32 and it's graded.
Okay.
And I got trays underneath and I fill them with cedar shavings and I'm trying to make him pee in the shavings. And I notice it seems like he's doing pretty good because I think he sniffs out the shavings. And, you know, then what I did was I took his pee and I kind of sopped it up with a paper towel and put it in the tray and then put it in the tray.
Okay. Well, yeah, no, I hear you. And I think you're doing something very smart, which is in training him to go on a particular substrate, and then you can control where that substrate is.
Right.
So it sounds like you're trying to train him to go on pine shavings, and then your idea is to move the shavings around so they're just in one area.
Right.
Underneath his cage. That's
the way to do it,
I think you're very smart, and I think there's a possibility that would work. So I would just keep it up. Don't go too far too fast, though.
Yeah.
You might want to, you know, the tendency might be to get that area of shavings a little bit too small, a little bit too fast.
Uh-huh.
So I don't know how long you've had him, but I would be very conservative about going too far too fast.
Okay.
So, yeah, so I let us know if it works.
Okay.
Give us a call back.
Okay, sounds great.
Thanks very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Well, now we've admitted that we're not chinchilla experts.
That's the truth.
What about rabbits?
Rabbits?
Yeah,
I know a little bit more about rabbits than I do chinchillas.
I know you do. We received a pet tip from Susanna in Gresham, Wisconsin, who trained her rabbit to go to the bathroom in a specific area.
Yes, as you often can do.
Yeah, she says that in training her baby bunny Snickers to use his litter pan, she only put litter in a specific corner of the cage.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing else but a towel, you know, lined the other part of the cage. So he would know where to cuddle up. You know, he had the towel to cuddle up.
Sure.
And this cut back any confusion as to where to go.
Yeah, and that's very smart. And here's the key to what this listener is reminding us all, which is really good, is it's about the substrate. So curl up on a little towel, you know, and that's mm-hmm. the place you sleep. And then you go on a particular kind of, you know, something. And even dogs are the same way. You can entrain them to go onto dirt or gravel or grass. And as a matter of fact, if you just take them out onto grass and you're traveling, you can't find grass, you can actually run into trouble. So with animals, you need to have be flexible. You want to actually do the opposite, which is teach them to go not on carpet or linoleum, but on gravel and dirt and grass, for example.
And she says, here's one other great advantage to it. It's also very easy to clean up.
Well, I think that's the point.
That's the whole point.
That's the whole idea. And that's a good thing.
And where do we send our pet tips again?
Oh, we love to hear from you. Send us at pettips@wpr.org.
And again, if you want to call us, here's that number, 1-800-462-7413. And here's another caller. Hi, you're on Calling All Pets.
Hi, this is Pam in Norfolk.
Norfolk, Virginia. Pam, thank you for calling.
Thanks. Hey, I have a question about my dog. I have a Rottweiler. I adopted him when he was about 1.5 years old from the SPCA locally. He's now almost turning 7.
Okay.
He likes to steal my underwear.
Oh,
and I know it's just my things because I'm testing him. Like, I'll put something else out for him to take, you know, to run off with it, but he doesn't do it. It's just my stuff. So I don't know if it's obviously stuff with my scent on it, but he takes it and he goes into a corner and you wouldn't want to go near him to get it away. He growls and he shows incredible dominance and aggression.
Yes.
So I was wondering what I can do to, you know, stop him
doing
that. Sure, you know, put my clothes up a little higher, but it's a little routine that he does before bed and early in the morning.
So before I answer your question, I want to say I have an image of you when you said that you tried it with other things. I have an image of you stealing other people's underwear just to try it out.
Actually, I have. I've like, okay, I know you're, I know you can almost tell when he's going to do it because the way his ears go back.
And oh, that's good.
His little cheeky movement, you know, the way he, you know, pitter-patters, you know, a Rottweiler pitter-pattering, but he does do it. But yeah, I'll you know, set a trap for him. Nope, and he goes right for mine. Like, he literally digs his nose down into the hamper or wherever he thinks that, you know, something might be thrown to get it.
He wants yours. So if you live in Norfolk, Virginia, and you're missing underwear, we know where it is. It's at Pam's house. But you know, and this is actually not uncommon for dogs to target objects that smell like their owners. And exactly why that's true, I don't know.
Who knows?
Who knows? But it's often done when there's a very, very special bond between the owner and the dog. So in a way, it's a compliment, but obviously it's also a problem.
Right.
So there are a couple of things I would do. One is I would select out my own underwear, and I would spray it with, bitter apple, something bitter, something that dogs don't like. You can even use, some dogs don't like a citrus kind of a spray. Citronella is sort of classic, that dogs don't like that smell. And so what you're going to do is you're going to create a habit where your underwear is in your laundry basket. Before you put it in there, you're going to have right beside the hamper, you're going to have
a spray
can of bitter apple, and you're going to spray it so it's just not so nice anymore. But beside your hamper, or wherever he tends to most often steal your underwear, you're going to have something that is appropriate for him. And since he likes soft things, you often want to focus on the texture that an animal is attracted to. So I would get plush toys, and I would spend a lot of time rubbing your hands on them. I would put them under my underarm, you know.
Sure, why not?
I would get your scent on them. You could even rub your underwear on them. Just get your scent. Get your scent on this object that you're going to have. Well, this is a biology show, you know. It's just like, this is just what it is, you know. But it's so scent-driven. I mean, that's the point, is it's so driven by smell and texture. So get a plush toy that's an appropriate toy for a dog. Get your scent on it. Put it by the place where he normally steals your underwear and encourage him to take that. So that's one aspect to this. Now, the other aspect is the fact that once he gets these things...
Yeah, how do you get your undies back?
He becomes aggressive. So if he gets something he shouldn't have, the most important thing for you to do is I want you to not get into a sort of face-to-face stare fight with him, because dogs tend to win those kind of confrontations. They have, you know, they have carpet knives in their mouths. And we don't. No. So if there's any chance this is going to go beyond him growling at you, it sounds like this is relatively serious, and Rotties are big dogs, you might want to contact a professional to come in and sort of help you through that phase of it.
Mm-hmm. I'm definitely on that page. That's probably the next thing I was thinking to do because I have been doing everything that you said and it's not working.
Oh, okay. Mm. You know, there's nothing wrong with going to get a coach. The best football player has a coach, right? Best tennis mm-hmm. player has a coach. Even professional dog trainers will bring in a friend to help them sort of have another second opinion. So, yeah, so get a coach.
Yeah, we have coaches.
We have coaches.
We have Cynthia and
That's
Brad.
That's right. We have our production people who make us sound like we know what we're doing.
Thanks for calling. Good luck.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, appreciate the call very much. Coming up next, we'll talk with a researcher and conservationist about the beautiful birds of the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, and they are beautiful. I'm Larry Mueller with Patricia McConnell, and this is Calling All Pets from Wisconsin Public Radio.
The Calling All Pets website offers online archives of the show, pet tips contributed by other listeners, and a complete list of guests featured on the program. Our website is callingallpets.org. That's callingallpets.org. Also, the radio store provides a selection of books and training guides featuring advice to deal with multi-dog households and leaving pets home alone. Information and ordering at 800-747-7444.
Welcome back to Calling All Pets. I'm Larry Mueller with Public Radio's favorite zoologist, Patricia McConnell. And this week we welcome Stephen Brown to the program. Stephen is the director of the Shorebird Conservation Research Program for the Manomet Center of Conservation Sciences. And he's most recently the editor of a book called Arctic Wings, Birds of the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. And he joins us today to talk about it. Welcome to the program, Stephen. Thanks for being with us today. Appreciate it very much.
Thanks very much for having me.
How many species of birds rely on the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge?
Well, you know, it's a number that's growing all the time. We don't know all the birds that use the refuge. We're up to 194 species that have been recorded there. But as more research is done, we find more birds all the time. In the process of the research for Arctic Wings, we added about 11 species that hadn't been on the official list. So there are about 157 on the coastal plain, and about almost 80 of those breed there. And it's a critical breeding area for many of the species that we see on southbound migration in the fall.
Hmm. Well, take us through a calendar year if you're an Arctic bird. When do key migratory events happen?
Well, right now, a lot of our birds are wintering either here or south of us. Many of the shorebirds that I work on winter in South America. So they're down there where the days are long and living is good, waiting for spring to come. And when spring comes, they'll start a northbound migration, move up through the United States and on into the Arctic. They'll nest in the very short Arctic summer, which is a bloom of productivity from invertebrates in that 24-hour daylight that happens up there in the summer, and they'll breed and raise their young and then start their southbound migration, some of them returning all the way back to southern South America in 1 year. Just a remarkable migration.
Stephen, can you tell us more about how these birds survive what are sometimes nonstop journeys across two continents?
It's just a remarkable feat. They have to build up a lot of fat stores. That's what they use for energy. And some of them almost double their weight before setting out on a journey. It's something, if you think about a human trying to do that, say a 160-pound human, that's about eating 1,600 cheeseburgers or 53 a day for a month. And imagine doing that and then running to Mexico without stopping to eat or drink. That's,
I think you'd
gives
need
you
to
an idea
stop
of what
to
they're
do
able
something
to do.
Else, too.
Yeah, you might have some other problems along the way.
You write specifically about shorebirds in this book, and you say that an Arctic shorebird carries clues about the health of the world's ecosystems. How do they do that, and what kinds of clues are they giving us today?
Well, one of the things we're learning from our studies of Arctic shorebirds is that there are a number of environmental problems scattered throughout the hemisphere. Because they use so many different habitats, they're indicators of the health of the ecosystem at a very large scale. For them to be successful, they need healthy habitats in South America, in the United States, where they migrate, and they need healthy habitats in the Arctic. And as we see some of the changes that are happening already from global climate change up in the Arctic, we're starting to see signals. Some of the shorebirds that we study are in pretty dire shape. Many of them are declining at rates that will cause them to go extinct in my children's lifetime if we don't reverse those rates of decline. So they're indicating some significant problems, but problems that we can solve if we start working on them now.
Speaking of working on them now, I think all of our listeners know that there's a lot of controversy about opening up the refuge for oil drilling.
That's right.
Do you consider that to be the biggest threat to the refuge today?
It's certainly the most pressing threat. It's one that, if it goes forward, will have immediate impacts. And to keep that in perspective, of the coastal plain of Alaska, about 95% is in a status that will be open for oil and gas development. So the coastal plain of the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge is really the last 5% of the nation's intact Arctic ecosystems. And that's what the debate is about. Are we going to develop the entire area or preserve this last 5% for wildlife, like these birds that migrate so far to use them? The oil supply that may be available there has been estimated between 3 and 6 months at the rate we use energy. It won't solve our long-term energy problems. It won't even really make an impact on the price of oil. It's just too small an amount to change world oil prices. So setting aside this last 5% as the wildlife refuge it was intended for, I think makes good sense as an investment in the future of our planet and our children's future.
And one of the things, as you mentioned, that you're trying to do is through your book to get people excited and interested. And the photography in the book, I have to mention, is quite striking and has to strike a chord with anyone who reads and looks at the book.
We were very fortunate to be able to work with some of the most prominent Arctic photographers who are working, and it's a very challenging place to work, as I'm sure you can imagine. Difficult temperatures, remote locations, and it's difficult on equipment. So these are some of the most dedicated photographers I know working in the Arctic, and we're really fortunate. Shubhankar Banerjee is featured in the book and has contributed some remarkable photographs that really take you there and show you what it's like. And in addition, there's a CD in the book. Martin Stewart put together some recordings, which your radio listeners would be very interested in, that present the sound of the refuge in the breeding season, just as if you were standing out on the Arctic refuge. It gives you an idea of the richness of the habitats and the large number of different diverse bird species that are there. So that's another way the book tries to help bring people into the refuge and show them what it's like.
And as you look at those photos and read the pieces in your book, you sometimes wonder, why would the birds choose to go there in the first place? Because it is a very kind of forbidding place in some ways.
Well, we believe that the strongest factor driving this kind of long-distance migration is the food supply that's available. I mentioned before that in the summer, the sun never sets north of the Arctic Circle. So on the coastal plain of the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge in summer, there's 24 hours of daylight. And that means that all of the insects that would, in our part of the world, have a whole year to carry out their life cycle, up there it's compressed into just a very few months. So the birds arrive and lay their eggs when it's still snowing, and then incubate them so that the chicks will hatch just as this enormous flush of insect life comes up. It's one of the other reasons it's very hard to work in the Arctic, is because those insects have a taste for biologist flesh as well. But they're great for the birds. They basically, the young chicks grow up on this rich protein diet from this huge abundance of insects, so it works out very well for them.
Tell us one of your best experiences or your most interesting experiences while working there.
Well, I'd have to say the most memorable experience was being charged by a grizzly bear. It's, of course, wildlife habitat for all kinds of creatures, including a population of grizzly bears. And, you know, they're living in the wild. They see somebody walking by, maybe food. And so their reaction often is to run away. But this particular one decided I was probably dinner. And I'll never forget the look in his eyes as he locked gazes with me across about a mile of tundra and came charging at me at about 35 miles an hour. They move faster than you can imagine across tundra. That's very difficult terrain for us to cover, but they can cover it in a as fast as you can imagine. And he changed his mind just at the last minute, but
wow.
It's an experience that will stay with me.
I would imagine. I would bet it is. Well, besides learning how to run faster or whatever it is you did, what would you say, Stephen, was the most important lesson or the most important thing that you learned from your work with Arctic shorebirds?
Well, I think when we went up there to do work, Manomet's a science-based organization, and we always try to speak from science information about the importance of a place or an issue. And when we went there, no one knew the importance of this place for shorebirds. When we got done, we now know that about 2% of the shorebirds that exist in this area, the whole hemisphere, nest in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge coastal plain, which is really a very small part of the area up there. That's about, like, if you compared that to the population of the United States, it would be equivalent to, say, Boston, Detroit, Chicago, Denver, and San Francisco added up. So it's a significant proportion of the population of birds, and we now know that they use this particular area for nesting, and that protecting it is a critical step in ensuring that their populations persist.
Stephen, thank you very much for being with us today. Appreciate it.
It's my pleasure.
Stephen Brown is the editor of Arctic Wings, Birds of the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, and he joined us today from the studios of WGBH in Boston. And he mentioned the CD, and there are some beautiful songs of birds on that CD. Let's listen for a few seconds. Beautiful, aren't they? Stay tuned. In a few minutes, we're going to give you a chance to win a copy of Stephen's book and the CD. Meanwhile, if you have a question for us, you can reach us at 1-800-462-7413. And let's take another call. Hi, you're on Calling All Pets.
Hi, this is Liz from Stuart, Florida.
Liz, pleasure to speak with you. What's on your mind?
I have a wonderful 4-year-old black lab named Sadie. And when I walk her, she plays dead.
Oh,
in the middle of the walk, the other day I was walking her, and I live in an apartment complex, and I got to this dumpster, and she was playing dead, and another car came up, and I tried to wave the car around, but the car stopped, and the lady got out and says, "Oh, my God, is everything okay? Is everything okay?"
Oh, no.
And I said, "Oh, yeah, she's just playing dead." And the lady said, "Well, she's doing a great job. She needs to receive an Academy Award for this."
Oh, no.
What does she do?
She literally puts on the brakes, lies down, and rolls over, where you literally would think the dog was seriously hurt or dead.
So this is the passive resistance, civil disobedience, just lie down, protest on the steps of the power plant kind of behavior.
Yes, it is. Today, this morning, I was rollerblading, and she did the same thing. I take her rollerblading with me.
You know, I had a St. Bernard who did the same thing, and that's an equal problem given that he weighed 180 pounds, and I couldn't pick him up and carry him home. And actually, that was a good thing because I couldn't pick him up and carry him home, I had to come up with another solution. So here's what I'd try. Let me ask you one question first.
Okay.
Does your lab love fetching tennis balls or eating, I don't know,
nice
steak?
Things.
Yes, she loves to play fetch, and she loves treats.
Okay.
I've tried the treat thing with her. It doesn't work.
So that's, well, one of the things to think about when you've tried treats is how do you define treat? Because there's sort of the equivalent of wheat germ, and there's the equivalent of filet mignon with rosemary reduction sauce. And so
you want the filet.
So you want the filet. You can skip the rosemary reduction sauce. Or something that your cheese, you know, peanut butter, something that your Labrador absolutely adores.
Okay.
What I want you to do is I want you to do whatever you need to do to prevent it from happening in the first place. So as soon as you see the signs, she'll probably give you signs, become a great observer, and figure out what does she do right before she actually plays dead. And as she starts to do that, I want you to click, click, smooch, smooch, get that piece of cheese or whatever, or tennis ball, if that's what she loves, right next to her nose, lure her up from the sidewalk, keep her standing, give her a treat, and then you know what I want you to do?
What?
I want you to keep walking.
Okay.
I want you to teach her that if you either don't lie down or get up from your lie down, you know what? we're not going to go back again. We're going to keep walking. And then, so start having these walks be sort of more back and forth rather than all out, turn around, all in. This is a classic behavior of dogs who were bred for lots of exercise. Labradors are high on the list. So exercise might be an issue. So that's another thing to think about is maybe a treadmill, you know, maybe a health club, maybe the doggy park, but more exercise for the dog and specifically teach her that you never know when the walk is over and it might not be now.
Yeah.
Okay.
Good luck.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Yeah. Thank you, Liz, very much for calling. 1-800-462-7413, the number for you to call. And don't touch that dial. Our animal trivia question of the week is next with your chance to win a copy of Arctic Wings. I'm Larry Mueller with Patricia McConnell, and this is Calling All Pets from Wisconsin Public Radio.
If you missed an episode of Calling All Pets, the show is available online. Our website offers archives of the show, along with the opportunity to submit email questions, browse pet tips, and learn more about a guest you heard on the program. More information available online at callingallpets.org. That's callingallpets.org.
This is Calling All Pets. I'm Larry Mueller, along with Public Radio's favorite zoologist, Patricia McConnell. And before we go back to the phones, it's time for our animal trivia question of the week. And if you think you know the answer to this week's question, give us a call at 1-800-462-7413. And all correct guessers will have their names pooled together, and a winner will be selected at random to win a copy of Stephen Brown's book, Arctic Wings. And this question has to do with the Arctic fox rather than with birds, so let's go to that question here. The Arctic fox is one of the many mammals that call the refuge home, and the Arctic fox has a warm white coat in the winter, as we know, and it feeds on things like lemmings, squirrels, berries, fish, all kinds of things. But in the winter, the Arctic fox will follow another white furry Arctic creature around, hoping to eat its leftovers. Which animal would that be? And if you think you know the answer, give us a call at 1-800-462-7413. And to find out the answer to this week's question, visit our website next week, and we'll have the answer posted at callingallpets.org. And now we're ready for some more calls. Hi, you're on Calling All Pets.
Yes, my name is Julia. I'm from Olive Branch, Mississippi.
Hi, Julia. Thanks for calling.
And I have a little Papillon who's 9 months old, and she chases her tail, but she gets very vicious about it.
Oh.
I mean, she snaps. If your hand happens to get in the way, you know, you can get snapped, too. And I can't even calm her down. I've held her. I've tried, you know, to distract her, but she just seems... It's just like her tail's a little enemy. She even gets mad at it sometimes when she's eating.
You know, this, it, believe it or not, it starts out being sort of funny sometimes when you first see it, but actually this can turn into a really serious problem. There are cats who attack their own tails or hindquarters, and there are some dogs who do the same thing. We don't completely understand it, but it's probably a neurological issue. You know how when people tragically sometimes have a limb amputated and they have what's called phantom pain?
Yeah.
Right.
And so the nerve endings are miscuing and telling the brain there's something there that's not there. It's very possible that there are there's some kind of nervous energy, there's some kind of stimulation from that area of your dog's body that is stimulating this kind of sort of what becomes an aggressive response. And so I'm glad you're calling because it is important to turn around. I've had clients whose dogs began injuring themselves or, as you mentioned, injured the person when they tried to stop it. Because
what I'm afraid of.
Yeah, and it's not very pretty to watch, is it?
No, it's not. And she's really vicious about it.
And she goes on and on?
Right.
Yeah.
So the first thing I would do is I would do a complete health check. You might have done that already.
I've done that.
I would include, and this is partly my bias because I've had such good luck with both human chiropractors and veterinary chiropractors, I would include a chiropractor in that who is board certified to work with animals. You can't just take, it's not legal in most states, you can't just take your dog to your chiropractor. And they need to know the difference. We're all built differently. So that's something that well might be worth your time and energy. Is there a pinched nerve? Is there something going on in that sense? The other thing to do is to try and figure out if there's a particular trigger. Sometimes there are environmental triggers that will start this. And then once it's started, it just goes on its own, and it's sort of self-reinforcing, and it's hard to get an animal out of a loop. But if you can find the first beginning indication that it's about to start, sometimes you can get them out of it. If you can possibly videotape, and this is tricky because what you want to videotape is the beginning, so you want your camera out before it starts.
Okay.
So, but think about and have your friends and family help you think about, is there anything we could do that would actually increase the probability this is going to occur? And see if you can elicit it. See if you can get it on tape if you need to. But the goal being to find something that your little dog does before she goes full bore into it, that's a precursor that will allow you to interrupt at that point and redirect her onto doing something else.
So catch her before she gets started.
Catch her before she gets started. Figure out what's the clue that's telling you she's about to start doing it. Redirect her to something else. Use anything that she loves. Use the best food in the world right by her nose. Use anything you need to teach her an incompatible behavior. The two other things quickly are, one is if she's completely into it, because she's small, there is sometimes small is really handy, and papillons are small little tiny dogs with big huge disproportionately large ears, is you can take a blanket and just throw it on top of her and then sort of scoop her up in this big thick heavy blanket. That will keep you protected. And sometimes it can just stop, it sort of interrupts and stops the behavior without you getting bitten. If this continues to increase in frequency such that it's happening a lot during the day, I would refer you to a veterinary behaviorist who's qualified to prescribe medications to try and turn this around.
And it's a tough one to deal with sometimes.
If you can find the trigger, then you can often get it turned around without having to go to any other lengths. So good luck.
Good luck. Thank you very much for calling. 1-800-462-7413, the number to call. And Tricia, time now for an email question from a listener named Layla in Oslo, Norway.
Okay. Ooh, that's fun to hear from Norway.
Yeah, she has a question for you. And here's what she writes. My husband and I live in an apartment in the city, and we want to get a cat. Because of where we live, the cat must be indoors only. And last night, we went to the local animal shelter, and were told that if we're going to have an indoor cat, we should have two cats. They said that cats need the company of other cats so they don't get lonely while we're at work, and also that adopting more than one cat will reduce the chances of developing behavioral problems. And we only plan on getting one cat. So, Tricia, is it true that cats should be adopted in twos? Layla says she definitely doesn't want a lonely cat, but if a cat can be single and happy, she'd rather just have that one.
Well, you know, that's a great question. And I can tell you definitively, the definitive answer is it depends.
Mm-hmm.
It depends. It really depends on the cats. There are some cats, and I've known many of them, who would much prefer to be single cats. Thank you very much. I have one myself in mm-hmm. my house. She's quite happy, as best I can tell, to interact with humans and dogs and not interested in any way in interacting with another cat. Thank you very much. There are other cats who are highly social. Cats are very plastic about their sociality. And there are other cats who are very social, would very much do better with another cat, would indeed be bored. But it is absolutely possible for you to get a cat who is comfortable.
I would say even likely.
This is not going to be a problem. I think what you would be best to do is to find a single cat who has been abandoned, who has lived on his or her own all the time, and has lived with humans, is comfortable and friendly. So, you know, don't get a feral cat that's only lived under a barn, and unless you want to try and, you know, rescue a cat like that. But otherwise, get a cat who's well socialized to people, but who's spent most of his or her life indoors on his or her own, and they'll be fine.
Just fine.
You want to be sure that the cat does have a lot to do. Think about vertical space is particularly important with cats in small areas. Lots of interactive toys, but that's more important to some cats than having what they see as a competitor and a harassment on the other side of the living room.
And I had two cats, and one liked to be alone, and the other one didn't. And so we, you know, they got along. But
they tolerated each other.
Frosty would have preferred to be by herself and be the only cat.
Yep, there are a lot of cats like that. So I hate to disagree with the experts at the Humane Society in Norway, but I do.
And if someone else has an email question, how do they email us?
Well, they send us an email to pets@wpr.org. We love to hear from you.
And here's the number to call with your question, 1-800-462-7413. And here is another caller. Hello, you're on Calling All Pets.
My name's Richard. I'm from Lake Villa, Illinois.
Richard, thank you very much for calling. What's on your mind?
Well, I've got a blended family here. I'm a dog owner who married a cat owner, and the dog used to eat on a schedule. The cats are used to eating all the time, and the dog's developed a taste for cat food.
Oh, yeah.
And mm-hmm. a few pounds along with it.
Oh, and, yeah.
Do cats need to eat all the time, or how do I handle this situation?
I would handle logistically if you possibly could. If you could create a situation in which the cats can eat free choice in an area where the dog can't get. Now, do you have huge cats and a tiny dog?
Well, the dog's getting bigger. I've got one big cat, one little cat, and one small dog.
How small is the dog?
He's a cockapoo, 20 pounds and grown.
So he probably can't jump up onto something the size of a washer or dryer or something like that, right?
Correct.
And can the cats?
Yes, they're both very mobile. They can get up on all the counters.
So there you go. You take Patricia McConnell's highly technical, highly educated solution, which is she feeds her cat on top of her chest freezer, which is about the height of a regular washing machine, in her utility room, because the cat can jump up, but the dogs can't.
Okay.
So that's the easiest way to do it. You know, life's too short to spend all your time trying to figure out how to train your dog not to eat cat food.
It's impossible.
I think pretty much.
Pretty much.
I wouldn't want it.
On the floor, he thinks it's his.
Yeah, and why not? You know, and why not? So that's what I do. Take the easy way out.
Okay.
All right. Thanks very much for calling. You know, you said life is too short, and I sometimes think this program is too short. We always have a lot of fun, don't we?
Well, it is fun. Well, but we'll be back next week, right?
We sure will. Patricia McConnell is a PhD certified applied animal behaviorist and adjunct associate professor of zoology at the University of Wisconsin in Madison, and she's here every week to give you practical advice about your pet's behavior. Calling All Pets is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio. Our executive producer is Charles Monroe Kane. Our producer is Cynthia Schuster. Brad Kohlberg is our technical director, and Leo Sidran composed our theme music. I'm Larry Mueller with Patricia McConnell, hoping you'll join us again next time for more Calling All Pets.
Copies of today's show are available through the radio store at 800-747-7444. Ask for program number 0623P. More pet tips and advice for training new dogs or leaving pets home alone are available online at callingallpets.org. Our website also features a complete list of past guests and online archives of the program. The website, once again, is callingallpets.org.
On the next Calling All Pets, join us to discover why prairie dogs have a vocabulary all their own.
And we'll also welcome a children's author who shares her how-to guide for introducing kids to dogs.
We hope you'll join us for that and more of your calls on the next Calling All Pets.